from 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about audio and braille literacy enhancement and how it helps people with print disabilities. Then we'll get a preview of the many shorts programs you can see during the Milwaukee Film Festival.
I've been calling it's the festival's buffet. You get an entree with the features, absolutely. Those are fantastic. And with the shorts programs, you really get to have a little bit of everything.
Plus, we'll speak with the authors of a historic recipe book.
At first, it was kind of a game to find the strangest recipes, take notes, and then we would share them with each other. And eventually, we said, well, we should really try to cook some of them.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The library is more than just books. In our series with the Milwaukee Public Library, Books and Beyond showcases just that. We share resources, book recommendations, and some cool stuff you might not know about. Today, we're learning about audio and braille literacy enhancement, or ABLE, a nonprofit housed in Milwaukee Public Library's Central Branch. ABLE transcribes materials into braille and audio formats for blind and print-disabled people to not only enhance literacy, but give people the tools they need to lead productive, independent, and dignified lives. ABLE has been doing this work for nearly 60 years, but as its executive director Cheryl Orgas says, they don't want to be the best-kept secret anymore. To learn about ABLE, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski met with Orgas, ABLE board member Shin-Yu Hippie, and volunteer reader Mike Brown at Central Library.
So we started in 1965 out of a woman's passion to make sure that her blind students had braille materials at the same time as her sighted peers. Sister Malmarie Stoll became a teacher of the visually impaired, and she worked with other community leaders to find a space where braille materials could be made. The Milwaukee Public Library formed a relationship with Sister Malmarie, and then we started volunteer services for the visually handicapped, which is now Audio and Braille Literacy Enhancement. I actually was one of those first students back in 1965 to get my braille books at the same time that sighted children had their print books. For me, this organization is a passion and a dedication because I know how much it meant to me to have my materials at the same time as my sighted peers. And I'm so grateful that now we are making materials available to blind and low vision students throughout our area. All our work is done with a team of staff and volunteers. We have over 50 volunteers for which without their tremendous efforts, we couldn't do the work that we would do, and or I'd have to find another $200,000 to $300,000. And you can imagine in these times that would be really tough.
Yes, yes. No matter how much fundraising there is, it's always a hard task. Now, for listeners, there's a few different terms we've been covering. There's braille and tactile production. So can you explain the difference between the two and share a bit of insight into how producing these materials work?
Braille is a complex code that blind people use to read with their fingers. That's a whole dot combination. We have certified braille transcribers who have to take a course of 20 lessons. It can take them over a year to finish, and then they have to do a 35-page manuscript in braille. Our braille staff and volunteers are all certified, so our work is very high quality. Tactiles are raised line drawings that one can read with their fingertips. So if a sighted student gets a map of Africa, our blind student is given a tactile map so they can read with their fingertips the lines of Africa, and they can read in braille the labels so that they understand, you know, what cities connect on the map. It's a very challenging process to learn how to make tactiles, but we have a number of staff and volunteers who are very committed to doing tactile work.
As you mentioned, you've worked with schools as well. So can you share like the average amount of time, say, it would take for you to translate a textbook that a student needs?
The work that we do, it varies quite a bit. If we do a literary assignment, and that might be a chapter book, that might take less time than if we do a map. We just finished a map of the ancient trade routes, and that took over 17 hours. Generally, we say Braille takes anywhere from 3 to 10 pages to do an hour. It depends on the complexity. Math is very complex, and we use a specialized code called the Nemeth code. And when we add in the tactiles, work could take much longer.
Now, Xinyu, you're a member of the board since 2023, so a recent board member, but you've been involved in and in getting materials from ABLE for much longer, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you share a bit of your story with me?
Yeah, so I just graduated college, just to give you an idea of...
Congratulations.
Thank you, of how long it's been. And even in college, ABLE did some work for me because I needed a couple of Braille tables. So I became a student of Milwaukee Public Schools when I was in... I want to say it was in 2013. And from that on, so from 6th grade to 12th grade when I graduated, ABLE did a lot of work for me. From I did Latin and Spanish in high school, so ABLE did a lot of foreign language transcription for me because I wasn't able to read that correctly. You can't always find those materials online to download. And then aside from that, ABLE did so many tactiles for science, so periodic tables, a lot of chemistry was probably a hard year for ABLE with all of the stuff I sent them. And Cheryl mentioned the map earlier. When I was in 8th grade, as part of my history class, I had to fill in blank maps of Europe and Africa as part of exams. So I still remember being given, they had to do a map with all of the names. And that was, you know, you can tell that it's big because on the bottom sides, they're taping multiple sheets of paper together.
Oh, yeah.
So they're having to do parts of maps on separate pages and then tape them together. And so I was given a blank version and a filled version. And just to illustrate, so ABLE's done, you know, from math and science all the way to the foreign language. And also, you know, I just wanted to highlight how ABLE has gone above and beyond. So I was a member of Academic Decathlon in high school for a couple of years, and ABLE brailled my math packets for me.
That's a
lot of math. It's higher level math too. They're getting into calculus, and ABLE didn't have to do that. That was not required for me to pass my classes. But we gave those packets to ABLE, and sure enough, they said, yeah, we'll do that for you. So really just that support system and knowing that I had a way to get Braille as a student, but also as an individual with a print disability was tremendous, especially as a student.
Absolutely. And people who don't have sight or print disabilities most likely don't think about the wider implications of not having access to these materials. So can you share a bit more about what's at risk if, say, you know, whether you've experienced this or a wider implication, like what's the risk for people if they don't have access to materials like this?
So when I think about this question, I really think about it from two perspectives. There's the practical risk and the practical consequence, which would be you don't have materials on time, which puts the student behind. And now we're having to find ways to catch up. And now we're having to wonder, how far behind will we fall? Because when you don't have materials on time, even if it's a graphic, the teacher will be explaining something and you just can't follow along, because without that same diagram rendered in a format that you can perceive, you can't really imagine concepts that you've never really gotten to experience. And so there's this practical implication of falling behind. And then the other side of that is the psychological. And this is something that I struggled with a lot, especially before I joined Milwaukee Public Schools. I had a year when I first moved to Milwaukee in a private school, where because I wasn't connected with MPS, I didn't know about ABLE at the time because I didn't have a teacher for the visually impaired. Private schools are not obligated to fund any of those public services. And so I had nothing besides, you know, Vision Forward, which is another organization here, did a lot for me, but I just didn't have the same resources. And I always thought psychologically, I'm not as smart as my other peers because I know I can tell, you know, you're very aware of what you're missing out on when you're not getting the same materials and in a way that you can read them. So I had a lot of insecurity about, you know, where am I? And I'm never going to catch up because I know that I'm missing out. So just to illustrate, the mental impact on a student's self-esteem can be quite detrimental when you know that you're falling behind and you don't have the services that ABLE provides to sort of help you catch up or help you stay caught up with the rest of your class.
Yeah, and I can't imagine the difficulties it is as a student. And Cheryl, perhaps you can share of your experience with visually impaired people. Is the onus on them to find resources? Is that the case often, unless they're fortunate enough to be in a school that has programs at the ready to connect them with?
Well, you actually, Audrey, give us an ideal gift by speaking with us, because sometimes I think we're still the best kept secret. My goal when I came here 18 years ago was to get the word out so that it wasn't the onus on the individual to get their materials, but that organizations would know to do that. And the word is getting around. So our signature service is working with first Milwaukee Public Schools and then schools in the area, West Allis, West Milwaukee, and other school districts as we can in Braille and tactiles. And in the audio program, it's our Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library Connection and our Wisconsin authors that we record. Beyond that, we continue to form relationships with organizations throughout the area. So we do the programs for the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, for the Marcus Center. We do work for Exfabula. We work with the Milwaukee County Transit System. We work with Milwaukee Public Museum, the Urban Ecology Center, and this list grows and grows and grows. So that is my long-term goal, that it shouldn't have been on the onus of the individual family with Shinyu's family to say, where am I going to get Braille materials for this student? And the relationship with Milwaukee Public Schools is so important because teachers know they can depend on us. And we do try to go above and beyond when we can and or stay ahead of the student as we can. This is really crucial work we are doing. This is life-changing work we are doing.
You know, we've been talking about the Braille and tactile, and you mentioned also the audio book programs, and of course, all the volunteers that help make this happen. So, Mike, I want to bring you in here. You are a volunteer audio reader for the program. So I'm hoping, can you share with me how you found out about this program? What motivated you to get involved?
My father lost his eyesight suddenly about 10 years ago, and he's elderly. So it's just a cascade of challenges for him to kind of manage through life. The one thing I did notice, though, was, you know, his passion for books blossomed because there was material configured for him in something called a Daisy Reader. You know, I saw it fill a big hole in his life, to be honest. And his connection to the outside world was really, you know, maintained by that. And so as I, you know, also thought about all the community of kind people, you know, that help the visually impaired, I wanted to join them. And it made sense to me to get involved in something that I saw that really made a difference in my father's life. I'm an amateur. Like, I don't have any particular skill other than some familiarity through public speaking and teleprompter training. So I will say it's really because they have professionals here that do the production that kind of makes it work. It's well set up. And the first book that I recorded here was an unusual book. It was about the history of high-profile crimes in Milwaukee. Yeah, it was a little ghoulish. But I sent a copy. Steve, my producer, made a USB copy that I was able to send up to my father in Canada as my first book. And he listened to it beginning to end. And it's like a son reading a book to his father, you know? And I think about that whenever I come in here. I feel like I'm reading to someone. And I think that's kind of nice, you know?
Absolutely. So, yeah. Well, I love the community that is formed around this mission. And I want to thank you all, Cheryl, Mike, and Xinyu, for welcoming me into your space today and sharing more about Able.
This is a great opportunity. We'd really appreciate you getting the word out about who we are. We don't want to be the best kept secret anymore. We want everybody to know about us.
Cheryl Orgis is the Executive Director of Audio and Braille Literacy Enhancement, also known as ABLE. Xinyu Hippie is an ABLE board member and Braille proofing volunteer. And Mike Brown is an audio reader volunteer. They all joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for our Books and Beyond series with the Milwaukee Public Library. To find more information about ABLE and to explore past Books and Beyond stories, head to WUWM.com. The Milwaukee Public Library is a financial supporter of WUWM. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll speak with the authors of a historic recipe book and look back on how people ate in the early 1900s. But first, we'll learn about the short films showing during the Milwaukee Film Festival. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Milwaukee Film Festival is in full swing, but you may be finding yourself overwhelmed by the hundreds of options of films to see during the festival. Well, how about picking a theme? Like Surprise, Surprise, Black Lens, For Kids, or Animated. They're all shorts programs included in the festival's run. To learn about what's being offered and to give a few recommendations, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Milwaukee Film Shorts programmer Jack Furia.
Film Fest season is upon us, and I love this time of year. And what I often recommend to people who might be overwhelmed by the selection options and not putting 10 films on their calendar is to go see a shorts program, because even if maybe one or two don't resonate with them, chances are they will find something that they'll enjoy watching. So what do you think are the benefits and the power of shorts?
Yeah, the benefits of the shorts program is that you get more films for your dollar, just straight up. You get to see, you know, between 5 to 8 or 9 films from around the world. I've been calling it's the festival's buffet. You get an entree with the features, absolutely. Those are fantastic. And with the shorts programs, you really get to have a little bit of everything. You might have like a little side of like a fun little Greek comedy or a coming of age film from New York or animated film from Georgia, the country, lots of fun stuff with shorts. And like you said, if you're not feeling a short, you're not into the story, don't worry, because in 5-6 minutes, it'll be over and a new one will start. I'd also say without a shorts program on your festival plan, you're not getting the full festival experience. Oh, I love shorts.
Oh, same. I agree with you. And with the shorts programming, they're all categorized by a theme, which is helpful for people if they like the sound of something, but you know, it's still a surprise when you go in to see these programs. So I want to start with Stranger Than Fiction. What can people expect out of this program?
Yeah, Milwaukee Film Festival goers love documentaries. These are our documentary shorts that we have. You'll get new films from 2-time Oscar winner Bren Proudfoot has a brand new film that's in this program. You get fun documentaries that explore unique subjects that are really wild and kind of hard to believe, including one about a man who got arrested for taking a picture of a donkey. I'll leave it at that. You have to come to the program to see and experience. We will also have the director of a really highly acclaimed short around the festival circuit called The Reality of Hope. The director will be with us in person. It's about two folks that found each other through a virtual reality hangout. And one of them ended up donating their kidney to the other one. It's a really beautiful story about connection and humanity that takes place in virtual reality.
I'm intrigued already. And to kind of go along with some of these you have to see to believe, one program I love and always make a point to have them on my calendar is Surprise, Surprise. So what film stood out to you most about the seven included in this lineup?
Well, first of all, we have, if you're a big fan of Hacks, Meg Stalter is the lead of this really quirky comedy about a woman who ends up calling her boss and accidentally says, "I love you." And she races around town to try to delete the message from his phone. And obviously, hijinks ensue. Surprise, Surprise is all about joy and laughter and twists. And they're going to be so special to experience with a full audience.
It just reminds me of, you know, maybe when you accidentally call your teacher mom or something.
Oh, man.
I feel like we've all had those moments.
And we have a short that kind of explores that. It's a PG-13 kind of rated R version of Inside Out about a guy who makes a joke at a party that really doesn't land. Then we go in his head as he tries to redeem himself and fails over and over again. It's incredibly relatable comedy. And that's what you get with Surprise, Surprise. You get some great big laughs.
Absolutely. And for this next one, what I'm going to say might throw people off if they're unfamiliar with the program or the experience of this showing. But one of my favorite things to do during the fest is to go to the midnight screening of the best midnight program ever. Don't worry, guys, I bleeped it out. But people can gather kind of from the mood that we're setting with this title. What is it for people who have not had the magic of experiencing this wild ride?
The shorts in midnight are meant for if you love the substance, you're gonna love the midnight shorts this year. It's squishy, weird body horror. You get wacky comedies, some disturbing animation, stuff that'll keep you up at night, whether it's from laughing out loud at how outlandish what you're watching is, or if it's because there are some genuine spooks that are in the midnight program. It's my favorite to stand in the back of the theater and watch people, again, like either they're squirming because what they're seeing is uncomfortable, or they're scared, or they're just having a great time. It is the highlight of the festival for me. I love the midnight shorts.
Now, as the programmer, are you trying to watch these movies that you're going to select for the midnight showing with other people, or are you just freaking out by yourself hoping that other people will also have the same reaction?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm usually watching midnight shorts at 11 in the morning. It's broad daylight. My husband will sometimes join me for watching them. And that's usually when it's the best, is to be like, okay, right, because we're going to have 300 people in the audience experiencing it. And that's part of why it's so special to watch it at the festival, because this program is really just ridiculous. And yeah, so it'll be so great to go from seeing these on my own in broad daylight to our gorgeous historic theaters.
Yeah, definitely the best venue for that. And if people are looking for a nice, easy entry point that isn't quite as extreme as the midnight showing, what shorts program would you recommend?
Grab Bag is the perfect place to start. This is where you see sort of the best of the best and films that couldn't fit into the programs that we have, like Date Night or Let's Get Animated. If we have too much of something, it can live in Grab Bag. And these are where you'll find audience winners, jury winners from big festivals like Sundance or South by Southwest. I truly believe that every filmmaker that's in the Grab Bag program is someone that we're going to see an incredible feature from in like 5 years. And we'll all get to be like, oh, well, I saw their very first film, their short film. It played the Milwaukee Film Festival in Grab Bag. But this is a chance if you like really have choice paralysis, you're so overwhelmed by all the options, this is one that just sit back, relax, enjoy 90 something minutes of great storytelling.
Now, if people are wanting to go to the festival with their children, I do want to mention there are multiple Kid Shorts programs too.
Yes, there are, programmed by Ian Cessna, our Rated K for Kids programmer. They range from our size small, best fit for 3 to 5 year olds, and go all the way up to size large for folks 10 or older. Sure.
10 to preteen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, these shorts programs are really heartwarming stuff. Size small, you get adorable animals and fun little stories. And then as you grow up to size large, that's where you get some films that are dealing with big emotions and stuff. Really great to bring the young folks into our historic theaters. Give them that festival experience because they deserve it.
Absolutely. And, you know, what adult doesn't like watching a kids program too, to be honest? We all need the brain break.
Especially after the night before, seeing the midnight shorts. Cleanse yourself with some wholesome all ages content.
Exactly. And just like with Cream City Cinema, there's also 3 Milwaukee short shows to show with this as well.
Yeah, we've got 2 Milwaukee shows this year. These are locally made short films. You'll get to have a really unique festival experience because typically the audience is full of folks that worked on those films. It's a really fun atmosphere. Each film has a guest or two that goes up for a Q&A after a block or two of films. And it's really great to get to hear from these emerging filmmakers or these established filmmakers, because we have a great film scene here in Milwaukee. There are incredible filmmakers in our city. So come celebrate them. And definitely come and support the Milwaukee Youth Show. This is the next generation of great filmmakers, not just great filmmakers in Milwaukee, but great filmmakers, period. I love the Milwaukee Youth Show. So, so great to see and listen to these emerging filmmakers say, you know, talk about their ideas and talk about the process that they use to make films. They are our smartest filmmakers.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see as many shorts programs as I can. But thank you for joining me today, Jack, to give some highlights and hopefully give some people ideas of what to circle in their calendars.
Absolutely. See you at the movies.
Jack Furia is the shorts programmer for Milwaukee Film. You can find more information about some of the films he and the Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke about at WUWM.com. Milwaukee Film is a financial supporter of WUWM. Coming up, we'll learn what it's like to translate historic recipes and try making one ourselves. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you're looking for a recipe today, chances are you're going to search for one online. But before the rise of the internet, newspapers were a common place to find new recipes, featuring the latest ingredients on the market. For 2 women working at the Wisconsin Historical Society, these old newspaper recipes inspired them to write a cookbook, featuring old recipes and historical anecdotes about how they came to be. Jane Conway and Randy Ramsden are the co-authors of Extra Extra Eat All About It. They join me now to share more. Jane, Randy, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us a bit about the journey to creating this book. What inspired it?
Well, we were working at the Wisconsin Historical Society digitizing historic newspapers for a online database, and we had to look at all of the pages that we were scanning to make sure that the images were clear, and so you kind of get to know the newspapers you're looking at, and we kept coming across a lot of recipes, and at first it was kind of a game to find, like, the strangest recipes, take notes, and then we would share them with with each other. And eventually we said, well, we should really try to cook some of them. And that's how it started. And it was really fun cooking and also doing the research, because there was a lot more research involved than we thought. We thought, oh, let's just cook it. How hard can it be? But then, right, you look into ingredients, or how would they have prepared this dish, or why would they have prepared this dish? So that's kind of how it started.
Yeah, it was just a real natural progression into a book. Truly just a total interest and hobby between both of us that turned into this really fun project.
It's interesting what you say about research, because I myself, I have a number of very old cookbooks, and you'll be reading kind of how they've written things out, and you're like, well, I think I know what they mean, or, you know, it'll be something like sour milk that they'll put in there, and you go, well, what did they mean by that? What level of research did you need to really understand the context of these recipes?
It was truly so much research that we had to do. There was a lot of just assumed knowledge that these newspapers thought that readers had interpreting these recipes that we've just lost by now reading them in 2025. So we really turned to the newspapers themselves to do a lot of our research. If we were wondering what sort of kitchen gadget they might have been using to do a certain part of the recipe, we'd see what advertisements were in the newspapers, what was being sold at the time, what was accessible to Wisconsinites. And we did the same for ingredients as well. We just looked through the newspapers to see what was there. They really were our main source for our research.
That is really interesting. So you went through the news. I mean, I guess that makes sense when you think about it. You go, if you're getting your recipes from the newspaper, you are likely getting some of these other things from the newspapers. What were some of the unusual ingredients that you came across that really stumped you for a minute, that you went, all right, we're just paging through trying to figure this one out?
Well, there's just like, now that some of the brand names have become the name for the ingredient. So there was some research there. We did a French dressing, and it called for a French mustard. I'm like, oh, what does that mean? And right, we ended up using Dijon just because we like the flavor of it. But the original may have also meant French's yellow mustard, because that was already available at the time. And they like to drop the S's of brand names. The same happened with German chocolate, right? It was invented by Sam German rather than being a product from Germany. And so that's really kind of the nuance there, that we started looking into the newspaper to see like what you would have been able to buy at the store, what was advertised, and kind of go from there.
One of the things that people will notice about these recipes when looking at especially the excerpts of them instead of how you've made them much more like a recipe that we'd see today is how they're written. Today, recipes are very formulaic. They are recipes, but that wasn't always the case back in the day. What would they look like, and what was it like translating that?
I think one of the most infamous recipes for both of us that we worked on translating and interpreting was Hamburg spaghetti, yes, which had this amazingly complicated recipe for a spaghetti dish with meatballs that was not written in chronological order. They would mention ingredients and then mention the amount of the ingredient you needed far down below in the recipe. And it was just such an interesting, challenging, and a fun process to kind of sort it out, get it in chronological order, get the amounts of the ingredients listed at the top. I think there's a lot of like standardization in how we expect recipes to look today that just was not commonplace in the newspapers. And it really varied how they were written. I wouldn't say there was one way that you'd expect. It was just all over the place.
Yeah. And there's a lot of like narrative to it.
Yes. Yeah.
What would you consider some of the more unusual recipes from this book? There, I will say, for people who read the book, there are many recipes that you're going to find fairly familiar, you know, different takes on a familiar classic, but there are some that are a little more odd.
Like bananas and ham?
That one, yeah. sounded so strange reading it. We were so intrigued, and it ended up tasting amazing. We loved it. The flavor combination worked so well, but it's just not something you'd ever expect to be making in your modern kitchen.
And that's another example for an ingredient where you just kind of have to do a little bit of interpretation, because bananas, or you don't necessarily know, do they mean the actual like sweet banana, or are they talking about plantains? But then we also found out that at the time, bananas, there were a whole different lot of varieties of bananas that probably tasted differently. We tried out the regular banana you can buy at the supermarket now, and we tried out the plantain. And I for sure thought, oh, they probably meant plantain. That's just, but the sweet banana actually tasted better. So that's what we put in the book.
What would you say are your favorite recipes from the book? You know, the ones that you've maybe incorporated into a meal or two.
I think we always recommend our stuffed onions cooked in a paper bag. It's almost our signature recipe. We love recommending that one. It's a crowd pleaser. I mean, it's onions stuffed with meat, herbs, chopped nuts, and then cooked in this paper bag with butter. So you really can't go wrong with that. And then a personal favorite of mine is our swimming island, which is a hard-boiled egg rolled in cinnamon and sugar, rolled in batter, deep fried, and then served with a hot sweetened wine poured over it. And it's amazing and very dramatic to present to guests. It's just such a fun one to serve.
That's so funny. So one of my colleagues and I are planning to make a recipe from the book. And I gave her a few options that I thought, you know, she would be interested in. She's not a fish person, so we sidestepped a number of the fish ones, and I wasn't quite sure. I was like, I think this stuffed onions might be something very approachable that you'd really like. And she was like, yeah, that sounds pretty good. And we have settled on the swimming island.
I'm so excited.
It's just so strange. You got to try it.
It tastes good, though. It really does. It's so unexpected. I think I've never had a scotch egg before, and I think that might be the most similar to it. So, yeah, but it really worked. It's tasty.
What is your advice to us as we embark on this?
Watch the amount of batter that you get onto the egg, because you have to keep repeating that process, and it can get out of hand pretty fast, and you'll just have this huge battered egg in the oil.
Yeah, the shape can change too, so it might look very different at the end than in the beginning.
Very aptly called an island, a little amorphic.
Yes.
So what would you say is your advice to people who are interested in trying out these kinds of archival recipes for themselves?
Oh, you just got to start. We were intimidated by some of them, but really you just, we did our research first. So we looked at the recipe to really write out the list of ingredients. And then if anything was unclear, then we would do some more research, which can lead you down all kinds of rabbit holes. So that might be hours, right? And then by the time you want to, if you still want to cook it that day, that might be a lot. But then, yeah, just experiment. And what I found really interesting through this whole process is how much fun it was, and the expectation. Maybe invite some friends to try it together. And right, this is not the recipe you own, and this is not the best you can do. This is just a fun thing from back in the day, and then you have something to talk about. That's kind of how we approached it. We had our little taste testing group, and so the pressure was really off of us having to cook this awesome meal. We just said, we're trying this recipe, let's have fun with it. And then everybody would taste it and give us feedback, and we would kind of talk about what taste people had back in the day. And so it can be really like a fun community event too.
That was Jane Conway and Randy Ramsden, co-authors of Extra Extra Eat All About It, Culinary Curiosities from Historic Wisconsin Newspapers. As promised, my colleague Excret Nunez joined me at my home to cook one of the more interesting recipes from the book, called Swimming Island. Essentially, it's a hard-boiled egg coated in pancake batter and deep-fried, which is then placed in a wine sauce.
The recipe was printed in 1910 in a Milwaukee-based German-language newspaper called Die Sonntagsbote, or the Sunday Messenger. Here's a glimpse into how we prepared the recipe with a guest appearance from my cat, Marvin.
So we do need a hard-boiled egg. Let me grab that. A third cup plus 1 tablespoon sugar. Yeah, I got sugar. This is only for one, so we're going to make...
Oh, okay, yeah. Just one.
We'll double it up, though. So sugar, 2 tablespoons of cinnamon, 2 tablespoons milk, oil for deep frying, and then 1 cup of red wine.
Whoa.
Okay.
Drinking on the job.
Drinking on the job.
Okay, so basically step one, it doesn't say to hard boil them, but step
peel
one,
hard-boiled
yeah, hard yeah. boil them. Okay, you've already.
These are hard boiled.
Okay, gotcha, cool.
So it wants us to peel the hard boiled eggs and toss in a bowl with 1/3 cup sugar and cinnamon. Make a not too thin pancake batter by combining the eggs and flour. Okay.
Do you want me to do one and you do one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I love hard-boiled eggs.
Me too.
I don't know, like, just the smell of them. Like, when they're boiling, maybe not so much, but, like, right now, like, smelling it, I'm like, this smells good to me. Like, I want to eat it. Here, I'll give you my scraps.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you did it real clean. So peel them and then
toss in a bowl with
a
1/3 cup sugar and cinnamon.
So 2/3 cup sugar. Oh, that's flour.
How much cinnamon? Oh, 2 tablespoons of cinnamon.
Okay.
So we're literally just tossing these hard-boiled eggs in powder.
Yeah.
Okay. Measure with your heart.
That feels very much like what this moment is. So 2, because this is a recipe for 1.
It's a lot of cinnamon.
And then, okay. So 1/3 cup, and I'll do 2/3 cup. I think that plus 1 is for later in the recipe.
Oh, okay. My God.
This seems like so much for two,
two eggs. The mountains of sugar awesome. And cinnamon is, like, taller than the eggs.
Make a not-too-thin pancake batter by combining the egg, flour, and milk. So you just want me to do...
Interesting. Okay. So kind of like... Not a crepe. Okay, no, not a crepe. We're not baking this or...
No, but it'll be like not a dissimilar batter, though.
Okay.
So I need 2...
Hello, Marvin. You need a little chef's hat?
So how much flour do you want me to do?
6 tablespoons of flour.
Ooh.
There's a lot of flour out in the world, Marvin, isn't there? Special guest.
Special guest Marvin. I forgot how attracted to this he would be because of the egg situation.
Okay, so we have the 2 eggs. Do we beat them yet? Or we just leave them in there?
That's a really good question.
Actually,
that's not a good idea. Why don't we beat them first?
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Be a little bit more difficult to. Alright.
So, after we finish mixing all these ingredients up together, we will dip these sugared eggs into the batter. And then we need to heat some oil in a pan.
No, this does look like maybe a pancake batter to me at this point. What do you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, I think it looks really nice. I think you did a really nice job. And it's not too thin. It is very much thick. It almost looks
thin.
Like frosting in a way. Yeah, okay. I think we're ready to heat some oil in a pan. Does it tell us how much oil? No.
It does not tell us how much oil.
It doesn't even list oil.
I got just, because it didn't actually list the oil that we're supposed to use, I just got a vegetable oil. Generally, if they're asking for just any oil, a lot of the time that means that they don't want the flavor of the oil to impact the actual recipe.
Mm.
And so going with something that's more neutral, you could do an avocado oil. This is likely mostly soybean oil, but something that's going to have a very neutral palate is usually
yeah.
what you want there.
That makes sense.
So let me get this going a bit. Why don't you helps me just roll the egg around.
In a pan over medium-high heat, deep fry the battered egg until golden brown.
Okay.
Okay, so we need to batter the egg.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Okay, wait, we are going to do this multiple times.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so then after we batter it, we deep fry it until it's golden brown, then we remove it from the oil and toss it again in sugar and cinnamon. Dunk it again in the pancake batter and fry. Repeat 3 times total.
Ah.
OMG.
Now, there's a lot of deep fry in that egg. Do we put in the cinnamon sugar again?
Yeah.
We remove
from the oil and then toss it again in the sugar and cinnamon. And then we dunk it again in the batter.
Trying to, like, get the egg.
And not just, like, a spoonful of batter.
Yeah, and not just, like, fully a spoonful of batter.
Oh.
Where
is it?
Yeah, look at that.
Nice.
Look at that cinnamon. Yeah. So.
Okay, so we're going to set them aside to cool off a little, but then we toss it again in sugar and cinnamon.
We'll do it again in cinnamon and sugar.
And then dunk it again in the pancake batter and fry.
I am going to start this sauce.
Okay.
Aside from, like, frying this egg, we are also making a wine sauce. And this is going to be... how much wine? 1 cup. Okay.
All right. We have 1 cup.
1 tablespoon of sugar, and then we stir until dissolved. Alright. I'm gonna say something controversial. See? This just smells like wine.
Let's do you guys one more time again! This is the last round. Okay.
Fry down.
Whoa, look at that island.
Oh, yeah. This is supposed to be, like, fully doused.
I can't wait to see what it looks like in the middle.
All right.
Spoons?
I guess. Spoons. Let's do spoons.
Cheers. Oh, I already got some yolk in mine. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's...
Okay.
Mine's, like, eggy.
Yeah, it's an egg. Let's try it.
Ready.
Okay. You're not into it?
Let's just say I'm glad I wasn't born in 1910.
I am not opposed to it. The one thing I'll say is, like...
Ew. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
What do you think?
I think it's okay. I get why they have you fry it 3 times. This could also be, like, my inexperience with frying, personally, but, like...
No, I don't think it's that.
It's just, like, not super crispy, and I think part of that is that, like, it's,
Straight up dough.
Well, it's straight up dough, but also, like, we just doused it in wine. And so, like, it's not going to remain crunchy with that kind of...
I just wish that I tasted more of the cinnamon and sugar. Like, we put so much cinnamon and sugar in it.
And you feel like you're not tasting it?
No, I'm just tasting, like, dough and egg.
Do you want to try mine? I feel like mine has a fair amount. Let me try yours.
Mine's, like, mush. Yours has more cinnamon and sugar.
I think mine does have more cinnamon sugar. I think that's part of this. Also, yeah, your yolk did kind of go everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one, I feel like because it's gotten kind of, like, mixed in with the wine more, you do have to, like, treat the island like an island. I think that's what it wants.
Okay, but this is actually really fun, though. Kind of, like...
I feel like these are things that everybody would have in their house, right?
Yeah.
You have, like, eggs a lot of the time. You're going to have flour, sugar, cinnamon.
Maybe some wine.
Yeah, like, in 1910, I think, like, part of why this would be an attractive recipe for people is, like, all of these ingredients are very accessible. You're going to have eggs. You're going to have oil. You're going to have, yeah, probably wine, at least a little bit. And this is what you come up with.
Would you eat again? Would you make again?
Would I eat it? If it were on a menu and, like, that was the choice for dessert, I wouldn't kick it out of bed.
Yeah!
But would I go out of my way to, like,
make it again?
I don't know. I think it's definitely worth trying if you're even, like, a little bit intrigued by it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me along on this journey. I will remember this.
That was myself and colleague Excret Nunez preparing the swimming island recipe featured in the cookbook Extra Extra Eat All About It, Culinary Curiosities from Historic Wisconsin Newspapers. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we're bringing back a short run of our series Tavern Tuesdays, where we explore the state's long relationship with beer and breweries. Plus, our latest Live at Lake Effect brings you music and a chat with David Shaw of the Revivalists. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.